God is creating a situation where we find ourselves questioning, you know, reality, the way things are, and turning away actually from God, because we no longer think of God as something that is an easy answer to all of our questions. But the answer is that that's true. God is not an easy answer. We realize that now we're looking at the world like God is looking at the world, the shattered crystal ball that needs to be put together with some knowledge of the way the world really is.
I engaged today in conversation with Charles Shiro Inoue, professor of Japanese literature and visual culture at Tufts University, where he served as both the department chair and dean of the colleges for undergraduate education. Charles is the author and editor of several important books in Japanese literature and culture. Last year, he published a poignant and compelling memoir titled Zion, Earth, Zen, Sky in the Neil A. Maxwell Living Faith series. As I have my own book coming out soon in that series, I talk with Charles today about his fascinating book and also the experience of writing a spiritual memoir, the challenges and rewards it presents, and the ways one's academic training both assists and impedes that endeavor. I'm Matthew Wickman, founding director of the BYU Humanities Center. Charles, it's great to talk with you this morning. Thanks for coming on to the podcast.
Nice to see you.
Good to see you too. You were out here in person at BYU actually a few months ago. I wish you were sitting across the desk right now. That was more preferable still, but still, I've got to say, it's good to get you over Zoom. Now, I usually begin this podcast by asking guests how faith figures into their life and work, and I won't begin that way today for a couple of reasons. First, you've written an entire book dedicated to that question, so, and we'll discuss your book, therefore we'll get to that question over the course of the interview, the conversation. But second, I've also written a book, on that subject. Now, your book was published last year. It's in print, whereas mine is not yet in print, and it keeps being delayed due to paper supply chain shortages. So it was going to be out in March, then April, then May, now June, and I'm figuring now, 2028 or something like this, you know. I do want to talk to you mostly about your book, though, but we'll compare notes on what it means to write a spiritual memoir. So I'll begin this way instead with you. When did you decide to write a book of this nature, this beautiful book, Zion, Earth, Zen, Sky? Was this something you planned to write for a long time, or was it inspiration that arrived unexpectedly?
Absolutely not planned. I've not been very good at keeping a journal. I've started many times, and I rarely get past the first few weeks. And so I've been living with this sense of feeling that, you know, I really need to leave something behind for my children, first of all. And so that was in the back of my mind, but I never really got started on anything like a project until I recently finished a number of other projects, and they were long and hard and still have not, you know, crossed the finish line. And as a kind of gift to myself, I said, well, you know, what would it be like to write a book where you didn't have to do years and years of research, and where you didn't have to, you know, finally tune the voice of the narrative and so on. And so I thought, as kind of a present to myself, I would start writing this book. And so I'm at the age where I don't sleep too well through the night, and I usually get up, you know, in the morning. So rather than fight, you know, and try to go to sleep, which I find kind of futile, I'm in the habit of working. So I usually wake up around 2 and I work for a couple hours, and then I go back to sleep, and that works for me, except during those 4 years when I was a seminary teacher, I couldn't go back to sleep. So during about a month or so, from 2 to 4 in the morning, at this time of dark quiet, I just started writing, and it just came out. You know, afterwards, when people talk to me about the book and ask me questions like, you know, why did you write it and how did it happen, I have to say that, as in many things of my life, I've been kind of led by the nose without even knowing it. You know, I think this is another example of responding to the spirit, to the inspiration that comes without really understanding why or even how. But you just do it because you feel like it's the thing to do, and in this case the result was something that a lot of people have appreciated, which is very satisfying to me, because most of my books interest about from 10 to 15 people.
Yeah, no, seriously, I get that completely. I've written those books myself. One thing you said, though, I want to pick up on. I thought this was interesting. You wonder what it would be like to write a book that didn't require years and years of research. And yet, as a reader of your book, Zion, Earth, Zen, Sky, it really strikes me as a book that has years and years, decades of deep reflection into it. So it didn't require back-end years of research. But man, was there a lot of work, you know, living in the production of a book like this one.
But it wasn't anything like a conscious effort. You know, I'm just living. I'm just trying to I'm just trying to get by from day to day. And so in that sense, it was effortless. You know, it was just remembering the things that happened. A lot of people are saying, wow, Charles, you must have a great journal to remember all those details. And in fact, I have no record at all of most of this stuff. But I do have a pretty sharp memory of a lot of these events. And I love the way that I could revisit those events and think about what they meant to me. Because as I've said to you before, I've been surprised by my life, and I like to think about what it means to be surprised, you know, to have things happen that you didn't expect, many of them much better than you could have done on your own, much better than you thought would happen, and so on. And that's a source of, for me, of very deep gratitude, you know, for the kind of life that I've been allowed to have.
Yeah, I mean, if readers or listeners haven't read this book, it's a gorgeous book, and I think very stylish in the way that it's written. It's got a very particular kind of quality to it, Charles. It's very unique in the way that it's written. Short bursts of reflection, you know, and almost haiku-like, and there's some haikus actually in the book, and then longer sections that are more meditative, reflective, or narrating sections of the book. I'm curious about this. Did the form of the book itself, the structures you took in writing it, did those forms elicit insights in the process of writing that you might not have known were in you?
So I have always loved this short form of poetry, and I've always been a great fan of Matsuo Basho, who is the god of haiku. Yeah. And I remember asking my students once towards the end of a class, of all the things we read this semester, which was the most interesting and which was the least interesting? And to my great surprise, they said that the least interesting thing we read was the poetry of Basho. And I thought to myself, what does it mean when you teach an introduction to Japanese culture class, and the thing that they like the least is the thing that most Japanese hold to be the kind of the essence of their culture? And I realized that I had blown it, that I was teaching a class that didn't teach the right thing. And so I revamped the class, and I made as a part of it the practice of teaching my students, each one of them, how to write haiku. And I did so as an attempt to awaken their sensitivity to the power of things around them. So it's a lyrical experience that requires some sensitivity to the reality of the material, physical, visible, world that we live in. And as I pursue this, sort of, you could call it animistic view of reality, which leads to this poetry, it has made me a different kind of writer, because, you know, I've always said to my students, you know, advanced writers think about what not to write, while beginning writers think about what to write. But it's become extreme to me, so that I'm writing, you know, in a way, I'm writing less and less and less as I become a better practitioner of this animistic lyrical relationship that we can have to reality. Does that make sense?
You bet it does, absolutely.
And so in that sense, this book was a breakthrough, because, you know, it was the first time that I published my poetry.
And, okay.
Yeah. So I had, and since then I've been writing more poetry, actually.
I've read a little bit more of the poetry that's in the book here, and it's really striking, the poetry that I've seen of yours, including what's in the book. And a lot of the sections, even that aren't poetry, have got a poetic quality to them. There's an economy of expression and a lighting on really vivid images. And then kind of a meditation around these images that I think is such an important part of what you do in the book, and that for the reader, you know, is such an engaging part of the process of reading the book. And one of the motifs in the book that I really love is that of raking a Zen garden. Okay, raking the sand until it is just so. You liken that thoughtfully to the experience of living the gospel as a member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And I'm going to quote you here. I'm jumping around just a little bit, but you write this. You write, "Our training is short on theology and long on practice. Our philosophical accomplishments are few, and our practical victories many. As with Zen, understanding comes to Latter-day Saints by doing the same things over and over. Latter-day truths of Zion are more like the small truths of Zen than like the big truths of traditional Christianity." You know, that's a really provocative statement, and I wonder if you could explain what you mean by things like practical victories and small truths.
If you ask me, how would we know that God really lives? And my answer to that question would be, we would know when our impulses are to be kind, to respond to people in need, to, you know, bake that plate of cookies or that loaf of bread, and just to take the care to do the things that we've, you know, agreed and promised to do. So on that very practical level, I think those are the things that I would immediately notice if they were gone. You know, if we had a spring and the birds didn't sing, I would notice that. If we had a church meeting on Sunday and I didn't feel the very practical attention that we have to each other, then I would notice that. Maybe God doesn't really exist. Maybe I've spent my life, you know, foolishly pursuing a vision of reality that is a fantasy. But to the extent that I notice people actually doing loving things for other people, then that makes me think that there's something here. Those big questions don't concern me so much as the manifestations that come because we are allowed to feel, you know, and God's love, and to see like God sees, you know.
Yeah,
I think your memoir is notable for putting the light on that very issue. I think, you know, the spiritual, the deeply spiritual nature of everything that we do.
That's an important theme to me. You know, the podcast here, this podcast that we're talking on, is very ecumenical in its nature. I talk to a lot of amazing people across different faith traditions, most Christian, though not exclusively. And I'm always taken with the manifestations of the Spirit in the lives of these people with whom I speak. You know, there's so much to which they respond that I say to myself, that's remarkable. I love those gifts that they are sharing in their work and then when they talk with me. And I was talking actually with one of the guests a few weeks back, Glenn Scorgi, about holy envy and the envy that we have. And when I was reading Zion, Earth, Zen, Sky, I felt this holy envy for the kind of Eastern wisdom that informs your Christian vision. So, for example, let me read you a couple of passages from your book and share with listeners here, and then ask you a question about these. Here's one. You say, a Buddhist would say that my problem is that I don't understand Anatman. Did I say that correctly?
Anatman, yeah.
Anatman, mm-hmm. Okay. The truth of no self. There is no such thing as the I that I worry about so much. In truth, there is really no soul to protect, nowhere to run to, no person to be. It will take me a long time to understand the nothingness of all things. It will take me many cycles of sin and repentance to understand that the world is filled with God's love, even to the point that I do not exist except as a manifestation of that love. I think that's so great, Charles, the connection of the anatman, kind of the no-self, into the no-self outside of God's love, which is a very kind of a Christian idea. It's beautiful. There's another passage right here that I love. You discuss how the earth does not revolve around the sun, but rather within the sun, that is, within the sun's solar wind, this heliosphere, which is much more massive than the sun itself, which actually encompasses the entire path of the earth's orbit. And you make this observation, I'm quoting you here, of course the gods are not way over there, while we are way over here. The Holy Ghost is to our heavenly parents as sunshine is to the sun. It's a beautiful observation. These are really provocative ideas to discuss them separately, but I really am moved in your book by the apparent ease, the grace of the way that Eastern thought energizes your understanding of theology. And so I guess I'll ask you this. To get to these insights, how much did you try to channel the force of Latter-day Saint religious culture or our customary habits of interpretation? And how much did you find yourself needing to kind of resist our culture in order to get at the theology that matters to you? How much did you find yourself having to sort of really focus on a larger theology than the one that's customarily talked about in our culture?
I've said this publicly already, and I'll say it one more time, that I think our, you know, we're kind of at a crisis point in our culture, our Latter-day Saint culture, and it's also at the same time a moment of wondrous, inspired blessings.
Yeah.
And I think that issue is that because the church as we know it began in around 1830, that means that it developed and grew up within a modern cultural context, and so we can't be too critical about the modern influences that have formed a part of Latter-day Saint culture. but from my point of view, this development within the modern period, toward the end, I would say, of the modern period, was both fortunate and unfortunate. Fortunate because it allowed certain things to develop, unfortunate because it allowed other things to also develop within our culture. And I think to respond to your issue about, you know, the East, because of my background as a Japanese American and my family's grounding in Pure Land Buddhism and the way that we were doing what we were doing within a context of Latter-day Saint culture, it made me very sensitive to the ways that things are in some sense similar, and in ways that some things are very different. Pure Land Buddhists believe in the notion of Buddha nature, this idea that everyone has the potential to become a bodhisattva, to, you know, be enlightened. And that's quite similar to our notion in the Latter-day Saint culture of the divine nature of the human and our ability to progress eternally. But there are many similarities, and what I noticed is that my study of Buddhism and Taoism and animism and so forth have given me moments of clarity, because I notice that they throw a light on certain aspects of our culture that are either obscured or forgotten or misunderstood, misinterpreted. Those are, you know, harsh criticisms coming from me, I think, but I extend them as a, you know, in the most helpful way that I can. I think that our culture, Latter-day Saint culture, has been built on a number of tremendous misunderstandings. One of them being that the Restoration, as we know it, is an extension of the Enlightenment, the modern period. This is a puzzle to me, because as far as I can tell, the modern era is essentially a secular era. So for Latter-day Saints to claim a modern position has always been a source of question for me. And my point, though, is that the comparison of cultures that produces what you're calling an elegant solution is, again, largely something that comes to me not because I tried at all to make some kind of synthesis happen. Again, it's just, again, as I said, I've just been led by the nose to understand certain things and have certain thoughts. And I think that the big surprise, since we're talking about surprises, is the way that Latter-day Saint life is so deeply surprising, is that, you know, talking about my own personal intellectual crises, I came to a point where I thought that I could not be who I am and be a Latter-day Saint. I couldn't honestly say that I could be someone who believed in the teachings of the gospel as we understand them. And there was a point where I actually decided not to continue. But at that very moment when I made that decision, I was gifted with an experience that reoriented me, made me think that, you know, maybe the point of your being a member of the church is something that you don't even get yet. And so I was instructed very clearly to keep the focus on the very simple things of, you know, how to love people and how to be loved. You have a home teacher, and he actually cares about you. You have a home teachee, and you actually need to care about her. And if you keep the focus there, then some of these other issues will be cleared away in time. And imagine my surprise when I find myself now looking at an intellectual environment where the reasons for my discomfort largely have been taken away, because the world itself has changed. You know, the world has grown tired of modern secularity. The world has realized, you know, what a cultural dead end modernity was. And imagine my surprise to think that Latter-day Saints in their belief in the spirit, the spirituality of all things, actually speaks directly to some of these very cutting edge ideas that are being floated today, including the, you know, the new materialism, including neo-animism, including the post-human, including the end of the secular period. You know, I mean, it's astounding to me that this is happening. You know, I didn't imagine it would ever happen, but it is, and I've played a small part in it. But the only reason I played a small part, been able to play a part at all, is because, you know, the attention to the raking stuff, the being present, being a helpful person, is the only thing that kept me in the game. It's the only thing that made me say, well, I don't understand this or that, but I'm still, you know, trying. And because I kept in the game and have been trying, I've been able to slowly understand things in a way that has come to this sort of synthesis that is such a surprise.
Yeah, I love that. Yeah, I think it's fantastic. It's very insightful, Charles. And I you know, the way I talk to myself about the cultural facets of my religion, really, for me, it ends up being more the culture I bring into my religion. And when I do that, I limit the possibilities for the ways I can be surprised spiritually by it. I know that when the spirit talks to me, there's always an aspect of surprise in it. I mean, there's some kind of affirmation of who I am, you know, I feel God's love, etc. But there's a second part to it, which is kind of like, I'm going to pop your brain open a little bit and give you something to think about you had not considered at all. And which is what, you know, for me, you know, my experience of my faith, of my religion, of the church, always exceeds my ability to think about it in advance. I when I think about it, I always make it smaller than it actually is. And this is what I love about you. What you say is that as you stay with it, as you rake that Zen garden, you know, as you do the small, simple acts about loving neighbors, loving those in your congregations, communities, things are revealed to you that you might not have seen if all you did was philosophize about the theology you were reading. That, to me, is the hallmark of authentic Christian living, and authentic living in the church, where it makes the church an ongoing revelatory process. To me, that's how it always has been most meaningful, is as that ongoing revelatory process. That confirms again and again for me the truthfulness of the gospel, that kind of experience.
And I feel, you know, there are a lot of people out there, and I hope some of them are listening today, that they have a question that they can't get an answer to, and because of that discomfort, they say, well, what the heck, you know, that's enough for me. But I would say to you, don't give up on something that is so good. I mean, yes, it might be that we misunderstand the goodness of God entirely, but that's no reason to leave the project of trying to understand, you know, what God, who God is, and what our relationship is to the things that are most important to us. You know, it's easy to lose faith, you know, and be frustrated, and, you know, think of the church as in terms of the people we don't like. You know, it's easy to get into that mode, but again, it's you know, if it helps to be Buddhist for a while, then I don't see a problem with that. It helps to be Confucius or Taoist or whatever. I don't think that's a problem. I think the problem is not the faulty search. The problem is the no search.
Yeah, good. Yes. Can I, in fact, on that subject about staying with it, can I read one of the passages in your book that I love so much? And you can comment on this, and maybe you already have, and say, yes, amen, done. You know, but this is, again, there, Charles, there are so many passages in your book I just love. Here's one. It's on page 134. You say, I'm slowly beginning to reassemble the pieces of my shattered crystal ball. I'm learning how not to make progress. Just to stay on my feet, that's it, that's enough. Even that will be a miracle. Even that will be Lehi's experience of the tree of God's love. All I need is shade on a hot day, a drink of water when I'm thirsty, something to eat when my stomach growls. That's all. That's plenty. Everything beyond our needs should be given to the poor. Why am I so selfish, so uncaring about others? It's a beautiful passage because, I mean, there's such wisdom in it, but it's also kind of recognizing in that spirit of being present what is most essential to life and the goodness of life. And why does, you know, I'll speak now, including myself, why do so many of our fixations focus on things about accumulation of massive amounts of resources as though that's somehow the purpose, you know, of existence, when all that really is kind of American hyper-individualism and economic fixation, you know, kind of tainting in a lot of ways our experience of what is truest and best about the gift of life that God gives us. So many of the parts of your book speak to that, I think, so eloquently. I love that.
Yeah. Well, you know, you and me are in the same business. We're an institution of higher education. But if you ask the question, you know, on the whole, does higher education make the world better or worse? I'm not really sure. I'm really sure that's such an easy question to answer, because if you think of all the terrible things that happen in the world and you say, well, was a college educated person involved in that problem? Usually the answer is, yeah, it is. So what that means is that we're doing something wrong, right? And what I think we're doing something wrong is that, you know, people come to be educated in order to have a career, when they should be coming in order to have a life. You know, you can have a career and still not have a life. But if you have a life, the career usually follows. And I think that we're not nearly as attentive enough to the basic things. I mean, I think BYU, because it's a church school and requires some attention to the ideas that matter, is, you know, you have a tremendous advantage, actually. You know, whether you're at BYU or at Tufts or wherever, it's the same problem. The same problem is how do we find our talent, develop our talent in order to use that talent for things that are good and honorable rather than just selfish, rather than just grasping or arrogant or whatever. You know, there are too many options, you know.
Absolutely. Yeah. Let me ask you a couple of questions here, and I'll try to respond to them myself about the experience of writing a spiritual memoir. I'm interested to know what. So your book's been in print for, you know, the better part of a year. I read it when I was first out of summer, wasn't it, last year when it came out. I remember reading it at a cabin setting in the mountains. It was a really great place to read a book like this. What do you hope your book accomplishes, you know, and to whom do you imagine yourself speaking?
That's really big. I've had numbers of people actually send me emails and stuff, and one of the most meaningful ones came from my roommate at Stanford, Scott Lambert, who's married to Wheatley, you know, which BYU people should know about. And Scott said to me, thank you for your book, Charles. Because of your book, I decided to write my own spiritual memoir. Mm. And I thought, yeah. I mean, if nothing else, people should realize, you know, there's nothing special about Charles. I'm just this goofy, you know, farm boy who is stumbling through life, having this experience, and they're no more interesting or no more valuable or no more meaningful than anybody else's. I'm kind of maybe a little bit more upfront about things, a little bit more honest about things because of the way I grew up. But if one effect of this book is to make people think, I can do that too, then that's exactly what should happen, right? This is not about me. This is about, you know, everybody having their own life and realizing that if they took a minute to write down, like, you know, Brother Eyring decided one day to do, the moments when the spirit actually made a difference in their experience, they would come up with a remarkable thing that they could have for themselves and they could share with their children, and their children someday would share with their children, and so on. You know, it's, again, it's one of these things that the spirit of Elijah is encouraging us to do, you know. And if we don't do it, it's like it's a waste. You know, the whole world is wasted if we don't turn our hearts to our ancestors and they turn theirs to ours.
Yeah, that's right. That's really good. And that really corresponds with my own experience of writing. You know, so in my case, the book I wrote, and that'll be out in a couple months, it was really born at a workshop for Latter-day Saint grad students I was asked to speak at. This is, you know, PhD students from around the country and even around the world who are Latter-day Saints. There's a workshop now held in the spring, like an early summer at BYU. I was asked to share my experience of holding on to my faith during my years in grad school. It was my friend George Hanley who organized the workshop in the first place. It was his sort of brainchild. He invited me to speak on that. And this was a rich topic for me because that process of my faith during my years as a grad student and beyond was rich but also layered and fraught. And I essentially came to the workshop and told a story about my experience of the complexities of the world, right? Complexities that had motivated my study of literature in the first place, after my mission. But more important than all these complexities, I wanted to tell a story about my experience of the grace of God and what that had meant to me when I'd been in these studies and when I'd had severe periods of doubt or disillusionment or anguish, disappointment, hurt, you know, various kinds. And when I finished that talk, it was clear that several of the students there in the room were moved. And the book was born at that moment, not because I felt like I've got to tell my story per se, but it was clear that stories like this, lots of stories like this, needed to be shared by people. I was one of many, and I should also, you know, share what I had to say. And so if I think about for myself what I want the book to accomplish, I guess I want it to serve as company for those who feel the pull of deconversion but who still want to make a place for God, those who want to reconcile their lives with religion and not break from it. And I also want my book to be company for those who either feel they have a complicated relationship with their faith or who want a more nuanced relationship with it. My experience of the grace of God has been that He accommodates, that God accommodates that desire for a rich and nuanced relationship, often by doing the simple things and staying, you know, in finding ways to stay in the faith as a spiritual discipline that brings us closer to God. And that is not easy to do. So many people in our world, many of my students, feel the tension between the desire to stay and belong, but also things pull them away, and learning how to, in your words now, rake that garden, you know, and keep raking it, I think is such an important thing to learn how to do. So I want to speak to that in my own book.
Yeah, you know, I just want to say that, you know, lots of people feel bad about their lack of faith and their doubts and their tussles with the church, but they shouldn't, you know. Why shouldn't they? Well, I'm pretty convinced now that our Heavenly Father wants us to have those moments, you know, that they're a part of our development. This is something that I wrote about in The End of the World, Plan B. You know, it was helped by a kind of a Buddhist paradigm, but I think it's also present in our faith. You know, when you think about, for example, Noah, right? So, you know, think about that moment when he jumps off the boat and his feet land in the mud. He sinks in a couple inches, right? What's going through his mind? Does he say, "Yes, we made it"? I don't think so. I think he is wondering, what was that? What happened there? And how could it possibly be? Come on. Everything that you taught me about yourself and your love for everyone, how does that jive with what just happened, right? The only people left are me and my family. You know, what about everybody else? And so in his anguish, Noah says, "You can't do that anymore. You can't do that. And promise me that you will never do that again." And God says, "Okay, sure. I'll put the rainbow in the sky," right? So, lesson learned. Well, it occurs to me that this narrative, this pattern of this narrative occurs again and again. You know, fifth chapter of Jacob, the whole, you know, Moses is another example. Enoch is another example. Abraham is another example. Muhammad is another example. Amida is another example. I mean, you see it again and again and again. And what is happening is that that God is creating a situation where we find ourselves questioning, you know, reality, the way things are, and turning away actually from God, because we no longer think of God as something that is an easy answer to all of our questions. But the answer is that's true. God is not an easy answer, you know. And when we turn around, we realize that now we're looking at the world like God is looking at the world. We're not looking at, you know, the fetishistic object of our faith, the truth, the perfection, the crystal ball that I thought I was supposed to be on my mission, right? Rather, we're looking at the shattered crystal ball that needs to be put together with some knowledge of the way the world really is. And frankly, you know, our fixation on the perfection of life and God as the, you know, the great, you know, the great Santa Claus in the sky, that's really getting in the way of our seeing things through his eyes. I mean, your book is about that too, you know, because there's no seeing God without seeing the things that God sees. And those things come at the same time. So there has to be this turning around where we find ourselves now standing shoulder to shoulder with God rather than face to face. And we march back down to the burning house in the world of suffering. Like we make our condescension like Jesus made his, and we realize that it's a setup. This life is a setup. And what we're being set up for is this moment of mediation that we slowly come to. You know, we're supposed to be mediators, just like Jesus was a mediator. And that only happens if we have some mature, you know, view of what it means to climb the ladder of choose the right and what it means to have justice. You know, people make justice in the modern world the end all and be all, but look, a world where everybody gets what they deserve, that's not a pretty picture.
No, it's certainly not in my case. You know that, and that's exactly right. Let me ask you maybe one or two more questions here in the time that we've got. What for you was most difficult about the process of writing your spiritual memoir? And did you feel you had to overcome anything in yourself in order to write it at all?
So, yeah, I, you know, to be really honest, What you have in this book is the edited version of my life. I could have, and I did actually put in stuff in this book that people thought would be wise to leave out. And in this process of leaving things out, I learned a lot. I showed this manuscript to my daughter, Mia, for example, and she said to me, "You know, Daddy, I'm really disappointed in how how really chauvinistic you really are. And, you know, the way you describe this person or the way you talk about this thing and so on reveals to my daughter all the ways that I am not really the kind of person that I'm wanting to be, as both as the author of this book and as a, you know, just a person. So those were the challenges, you know, that came along. There are big chunks of my life that are obviously missing to anyone who is paying attention. And I remember the moment when one of the readers at the Maxwell Institute, I think she was probably young, noted this missing part and says, "Well, how come you don't talk about this, right? And you spend so little time talking about this." And what she doesn't know is that I talked about those things.
Right.
But we had to leave them out because the people involved didn't want them in, and I had to honor their wishes, you know. But that process of editing, you know, the very difficult process of asking yourself, what can you leave in and what can you not leave in? That's hard.
Yeah.
Hard. Because it means that you are a person that, you didn't do the right thing, you know. You didn't understand. You didn't, given this situation, you kind of blew it. And you blew it so badly that, you know, it's in this forum, it's not even something we would talk about. If I'm writing a novel, I recently wrote 5 short stories, and I approached the Maxwell Institute about them, and they says, "Well, these stories probably would be better from somewhere else." And I think I'm hoping that the by common consent people will publish the stories, because it's a different genre, you know, and it's a little rougher than what I could write in this book. But those stories are also an aspect of who I am, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And they may not be, you know, the likable gray-haired guy raking his Zen garden. But they're also part of who I am, I have to say.
Yeah, you bet. I think that's really profound what you said your daughter told you about the disappointment, which comes if you're really, really divulging like a lot of not just your current thinking, but your process of thinking as you kind of move through life. Ideally, you know, we all become a bit more evolved and wiser as we age. That was a challenge for me also, is including trying to capture the voice of a younger version of myself and letting that voice speak in an authentic way, but not in a way that overpowered the larger story I was trying to tell about the things that have most affected or moved me. If I were to respond to that question, what was hardest to write about it? I think for me, it was overcoming, you spoke to this earlier, Charles, overcoming my propensities as an academic writer, okay, toward excessive abstraction or writing with only a very few, very select number of readers in mind. Mostly, that meant overcoming my deep-seated, almost primal fear of making myself really vulnerable in the writing. Because for me, the book that I wrote, at least by my standards, it's a pretty vulnerable book. Faith itself, for me, is a vulnerable subject, especially given the perceived, and certainly for me, the felt intellectual authority of atheism across so much of higher education, which is not to say that higher ed actually is atheistic, but the secularization narrative, you know, kind of the easy, really mostly lazy story about the fall from away from religion, the fall from belief in God, that story has got such a gravity to it. It's like a black hole. It sucks other stories into itself, or so it's felt to me, you know, as someone whose faith renders him vulnerable. And so the process of learning to be vulnerable as a writer was really key. And it reminded me of taking acting classes when I was very young in college. And the teachers that I had, who were themselves actors, would try to sort of get us to reach some deeper place inside of us, an authentic place that wasn't about character. It was about touching something in yourself that allowed you to relate more universally to others and therefore to be in a character, not just kind of act out a character. Getting to that vulnerable place that could be then more universally, I think, recognized as being deeply humanly shared, that was difficult. Getting to places that were raw and authentic and deeply felt. And writing this book reminded me of those acting exercises when I was a much younger person. So that was what I found especially difficult about this experience. Let me leave you this question here. I'm interested in your response. I've got a response of my own. In fact, I'll give my response first because I want you to have the last word on this. What moves you when you read a spiritual memoir? And is the book that you wrote that kind of memoir that moves you? So here's how, you know, I'd respond. When I read these kinds of things, I'm moved by a unique combination of experience and insight. You know, with the former, the experience giving birth to the latter, these insights. Books like that help me feel less spiritually lonely. They're good, and if not godly, at least discipled company for me to keep. And they inspire. They don't inspire me so much to want to be a better person, but more like to want to be who I most authentically am as part of God's creation. So a good spiritual memoir to me always makes me feel like I'm part of a much larger and yet more deeply intimate world, you know, where God's connected to me and to other people, and that we're all kind of bound together in something. And if I ask myself whether I managed to write a book like that, I'd say maybe in snatches, you know, in a section here or a section there, though I certainly have not perfected that kind of writing yet. I'm still working at it. I hope the book communicates with people and that they see something of what I'm trying to do in it. But I do know I can still be better at writing in that kind of style. So that's how I'd answer my own question. I'm curious for you, you know, what moves you when you read a spiritual memoir, and is that the book that you wrote?
Well, you know, let me just say this, that the things that I like about my book are the things that I like about my life. And almost always, the things that I really like are the things that come as a response to inspiration. Sometimes feels like punishment. Sometimes feels like encouragement. Sometimes feels like appreciation. So when I read my book and I say, you know, the question comes to my mind, did I write this? Then I think that I'm writing like I should write, you know. Does that make sense at
it
all?
Yes, it does make sense, absolutely. Yep. I found myself surprised by my own book in places. I thought, you know, wow, I didn't know I quite had that in me. which was a sign I was doing something right, that it was, you know, familiar enough to write about, but not in the way I anticipated writing about it. It seemed like the trace of inspiration. And I see all kinds of those in your book. thank you so much for your time, for your beautiful work, for sharing your wisdom. It's a joy. Those, again, who haven't read this book, Zion Earth, Zen Sky, I highly recommend it. It's a beautiful, beautiful book. And it's been great talking with you. And have a great rest of your day.
I will. Thanks a lot.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Faith and Imagination Podcast. This podcast is sponsored by the BYU Humanities Center and the College of Humanities at Brigham Young University, and is produced and edited by Abby Thatcher and Bobby May. The music for this podcast is composed by Ethan Wickman and is performed by Nicholas Phillips on Albany Records. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave us a review on your podcast platform. And if you're interested in other episodes or would like to know more about the BYU Humanities Center, check out our website at humanitiescenter.byu.edu. Thanks again for listening.